This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, you're listening to Bookmark. I'm Uma Paganampike Pagan, and this is Invisible Cities, the show in which I take you on a journey to all of those places, both real and imagined, to all of those places you can only find within the pages of a good book. Now, when Raffles set sail from the cold, damp confines of Georgian London to make his name and fortune in the tropics, he is joined, at first, by Olivia Mariam Fancourt, and later, after Olivia's death, by Sophia Hull. The both of them were his first and second wives. Olivia and Sophia, a brand new historical novel by Rosie Milne, follows the talented and highly driven Raffles as he sets sail from Georgian London to make his name in Penang, where he was assisted secretary to the Governor General. It tells the story of his two wives and the tremendous influence they had upon his life and legacy. Joining me today to talk about her book is author Rosie Milne. Talk to me about Olivia and Sophia and just how much of a departure that was, because it's historical fiction which requires a certain amount of authenticity, I'm assuming.
This was a huge issue for me. As I just said, it is the first historical novel I've written, and I very much doubt I'll ever write another strictly historical novel because I found it so difficult. I basically wanted to play so much with history that the history became very much fiction to a certain extent. I bent dates, I altered things. I say in my acknowledgements that I treated history as the first draft for a novel, and I did, but I also did want to be authentic, you know, true to the characters, true to their experience of the time, which I have to imagine, of course. I've got no direct access to their experience of the time, but I didn't want there to be any anachronisms, and I hope that there weren't. But it is a difficult balance. How true do you want to be to the history whilst also writing a good novel, what you hope is a good novel? And I always, when it came to prioritising between history and writing what I hoped readers would find interesting, what I hoped would be true to the characters, I always opted to more or less ignore history and be true to fiction, or to the truth of fiction rather than the truth of history. So the whole authenticity question was a big one for me, which I didn't really truly anticipate before I started. I just plunged in and started writing it, and then started thinking, oh my goodness, I can't do that. You know, that wasn't historical. Oh my goodness, I can't do that. It wasn't historical. But as I went through the writing process, I loosened up sort of the strings of history, so to speak, and got a lot freer. And I hope the novel reads as a novel and not as state history. I mean, it's not intended to be history, it's intended to be a novel, and I hope that readers read it as a novel, so character-based.
In your experience, is there like a rule or a general practice when it comes to adapting or writing historical fiction that people expect a certain amount of... Is there a percentage? Is what I'm asking.
There are no rules. There are no rules to life, no rules to fiction. So if there are rules of historical fiction, you know, genre, if there are rules that authors are supposed to stick to when they're writing historical fiction, then I almost certainly wrote millions of them, because A, I wasn't aware of them, and B, I don't think that any sort of fiction is rule-based. So, I mean, I suppose you could say, you know, if you're writing a Mills and Boone, there has to be a hero, there has to be a heroine. They have to meet all sorts of problems. They have to resolve the problems and have a happy ending. Or there has to be, you know, they have to be madly in love, but then there's a weepy ending. So I suppose in that sense there are rules. But if there are rules, I think they're there to be broken and to be played with and to disregard as and when you want to disregard them. So I wasn't really concerned by the rules of historical fiction, and I can't really answer the questions. Is there a percentage? Because I wasn't really sticking to the rules.
When I read historical fiction, I do have a filter on, in that I don't expect it to be the truth. I don't expect to be informed by it. I'm expecting I'm expecting a lark. I'm expecting a good time. If I wanted history, I'd read history. And I don't know how many readers get that or understand that. And what's the response been from readers to you? Are people expecting, because obviously I know about Stanford Raffles because that's what we're taught in school. However, yeah. we're taught yeah. absolutely nothing about his wives who made the trip with him.
Sure. Yes. Now, this is a really interesting point. I'm glad that you read it, read it as a novel, because that was how I really assumed. I didn't think it through terribly much before, and I just assumed it would be read as a novel. But I do know from readers' reactions that a lot of people have been taken aback that it is so novelistic. They were expecting a straight history. And I think a lot of readers here were expecting a straightforward history, a non-fiction history. And I think that's partly just, you know, the look of the cover. It looks quite non-fiction.
Yes, it does. Actually, you know what else it is, Rosie? It's also, when I got the book, when I received the book, your publisher sent me a copy. And when I received the book, I think it was the subtitle initially, The Adventures of Sir Thomas Stanford yes, Raffles, yes. the remarkable founder of Singapore, yes. as seen through the eyes of his two wives. Yes. And I think it was that subtitle yes. that made me think this was a piece of history. I think in the vein of, I don't know, Simon Sharma, that kind of stuff. And
yes. Well, that's the subtitle. I think that was really because the book is being sold in the UK as well. So in the UK, do people know who Raffles is? So there had to be some cover that told people who Raffles was. And we came up with that subtitle. You know, who is Raffles? He's the remarkable founder of Singapore, if, by the way, you haven't heard him. But, of course, here and in Malaysia and in Indonesia, that's totally unnecessary. But it's the same cover for here and for the UK. So that subtitle was intended to be informative. It was intended to tell people who didn't know who Raffles was that Raffles founded Singapore. So that explains that. And I don't know. I mean, I don't think everybody's read it as history. I just think that more people were expecting it to be more historical than it actually is, whereas I all thought this was a novel.
So talk to me about his two wives. Yet again, yeah. it's not something that we get taught in schools. It's something that's obviously conveniently left out. But they played an incredible role in the founding of Singapore as well.
Well, Sophia did, yes. They were very, very different women. They were sort of chalk and cheese or, you know, coffee and tea or cat and dog. I mean, they were completely different. So, Olivia was extremely beautiful, extremely sexy. She had a really scandalous past.
She was older than him.
She was 10 years older than Raffles, but he was her toy boy. There were all sorts of rumors flying around about whether theirs was truly a love match or whether they'd married her. They calculated that it was in their best interests. There was a theory that she'd actually had an affair with Raffles' superior at the East India Company. And when the boss had got bored of her, he'd arranged basically for her to marry Raffles and for Raffles to get promoted. So, you know, Olivia was taken off his hands, got a husband, and Raffles got out of it promotion from London to Penang. Now, I don't think that was true. You know, there are all sorts of interpretations. I mean, history isn't just this is a fact and that's a fact. I just took a line that was actually not correct and they had a love match. But it was she wasn't, we don't think, particularly well educated. There's very, very little known about her. You know, she was supposed to have been born in Madras, and you can believe that, you know, I gave her a mother who was possibly a slave. So it was known that she was from Ireland or spent a lot of the time in Ireland, that she did have these Circassian roots and that she died. I mean, that's pretty much all that was known about her. And she had an illegitimate daughter. Before she married Raffles, she had an illegitimate daughter. So she was this very scandalous, very sexy. She was a man's woman. And I think she pretty much did lead Raffles a merry dance. And she wasn't at all religious. And she was, in some ways, she was quite open-minded in terms of interaction with local people, but in other ways she wasn't. I mean, she wanted to change the way they dressed. She wanted to have them not chewing syrup, for instance. But she was a very feisty, lively lady. And she drank very heavily, we think. So that was also quite interesting. But Sophia was very respectable, from quite a well-off middle-class family in England, extremely religious, very, very religious. And the biggest difference between the two marriages, not between the two women, Olivia and Raffles had no children, but Sophia gave Raffles children. She made him into a father. So she was a much more and she was an adoring life. Whereas Olivia had led Raffles a merry dance, it was a load of trouble. Sophia was the adoring wife who hung on her husband's every word and lived her life through her husband, sort of wrote her story around his story, so to speak. And then when Raffles died, it was Sophia who secured his reputation. She wrote she compiled a huge memoir of him, which secured his reputation and ultimately was the reason why he became a hero of empire. So Raffles was, during colonial times or later colonial times, a big hero of the empire. And that was largely down to Sophia and her memoir.
But of course, they had a pretty tragic life together as well. Many of their children died.
Yes, yes. Raffles, after he came out at Olivia, that was the first tragedy in Asia for him, that Olivia died. Then he went to England, married Sophia, and they moved out. They, in fact, went to Bencoolen on Sumatra, whereas Raffles and Olivia spent most of the time in what is now Malaysia. Raffles and Sophia spent a lot of time on Bencoolen, and they did. They had five children in a very short space of time, but four of them died. And of those four, all of fevers, of those four, three of them died within sort of 6 months, you know, one in July, then two the following January. And then the fourth one, a baby that they had subsequently, died a couple of years later. So they had a dreadful, dreadful, dreadful time. And their one remaining child, Ella, they sent back to England. And this is not covered in the novel because the novel stops with Raffles' death. But in fact, she also died. She died at 19 on the eve of her engagement. So Raffles and Sophia, despite having five children, had no direct descendants. They did. Raffles did have a nephew that he who became his who inherited his estate, but they had no children. Well, they did. They had five children, but all of them ultimately died, and four of them in Asia, and three of them within 6 months. So, you know, unimaginably difficult. But you know, a novelist's job is to imagine these things. But it was extremely. It's extremely difficult to think what it must have been like for Sophia and for Raffles to lose four children so quickly, or at all. Okay. Hello, my name is Rosie Milne. I'm an expat living in Singapore. I'm originally from England, but I've lived in Hong Kong, New York, and I've had spent some time in Tokyo. I've published three novels. The first two were called How to Change Your Life and Holding the Baby, and they were modern chick lit novels. And then I wrote Olivia and Sophia, which is an historical novel exploring the lives of Raffles' two wives, Olivia and Sophia. And so it was a big departure for me to go from modern chick lit to historical fiction. But it was really interesting, and it was great to do so while living in Singapore.
One thing I really enjoyed about your novel was that it managed to capture the essence of what it was like to travel at that time. I think we forget that in the 1800s, it's a truly perilous time, and you're traveling across the world in what is just dire circumstances.
Yes, yes. No, that was the horrors of sea voyage at the time were also new to me. I mean, you know, we get on an A380 and fly from Kuala Lumpur to Sydney, or from Singapore to London. You know, at the time, they got on these tiny little wooden ships. It was before there were stabilizers, so they tossed and they pitched and they rolled, and almost everybody was horribly seasick. They couldn't store enough fresh meat or fresh water, so they had to have, for meat and milk, they had to have farm animals sailing with them, you know, the cows and chickens, so they could have eggs and milk. So they absolutely stank. The cabins were tiny, airless. Hygiene on board was pretty horrific. I mean, I think the decks were washed down once a week, but, you know, people were getting sick all over the place. You know, there were chamber pots. It sounds absolutely revolting. And there was no light in the cabins. Obviously, this was before electric light. And they were allowed candles in the day, but at night they weren't allowed candles because of the risk of fire. And it was incredibly dangerous. You know, shipwreck was a real risk, and a really big risk. You know, lots of ships went down. Pirates were a risk. Disease at sea was a risk. Fire was a risk. In fact, Raffles and Sophia were involved in a fire at sea, and they lost all their possessions as they were sailing back from Asia back to England after he'd founded Singapore. yes, the journeys were dangerous, difficult, unpleasant. And one of the big things that I thought after writing the novel was how lucky we are, not just for travel, ease of travel, but for all sorts of reasons, how lucky we are to be alive today and not then.
And also, if you're a seaman, it's understandable. Mm. You've signed up for the job, mm-hmm. but for women and children.
Yes. I think the women who went out, and the men, all the people who travelled from Europe to Asia. Now, you can, whatever you want to, however you criticize the political motives and the trading motives, you know, they might have come out for not the best of reasons, but they were incredibly brave. I mean, to just leave everything. Look, it was like if I today said, right, I'm going to get the space shuttle and go to the moon, that must have been more like what Olivia and Sophia felt.
Absolutely.
As they were leaving London to go on these little tiny ships to this place they'd never, probably never even knew nothing about, or knew nothing apart from that where to pass point to it on a map. You know, communications, I can pick up the phone and phone London, or I can send an email, or I can Skype, or whatever. Letters took the same amount of time as the ship journey, you know, the voyage, which could be up to 10 months. It could be up to 10 months from London to Malacca, and 10 months the other way. So letters could easily take the best part of 2 years. You know, you write it, you send it, you get the reply. It could take the best part of 2 years. And letters were always getting lost, and people never knew what was going on in London, or home. So yes, it would have been very, very difficult for them at the time. And I think they were admirable. Admirably brave, even if you look forward to the empire and you think, God, these are dreadful, you know, it was just awful. Colonialism was awful, which I think is undisputed. Nobody nowadays would try to argue for the colonial project. But the people involved were very brave to do what they did, just to leave everything, launch themselves into the unknown with a real risk of death. So, yeah, I think they were very brave women and men.
And of course, very little is actually written about these women who did make the journey.
Yes, there's not all that much written about them. No, they're not. It's not quite true to say that they're forgotten voices of the colonial era. But you know, there is a lot more written about men. I think that's true than there is about the women of the time and the women's role in empire building.
Before I let you go, Rosie, I need to ask, because I enjoy whenever someone writes a historical piece of fiction about Singapore, I have to ask, what was Raffles' Singapore like? Because it's so hard to picture now when we see Singapore today.
Yes. Yeah, it is. It's incredible. In fact, I went to what is now Fort Canning Park, which was at the time Government Hill, and I stood where the bungalow that Raffles lived in at the time. There was now a reproduction on the site. And I looked out and I thought, you know, now you see skyscrapers and you see modern buildings and you see roads and you see traffic. You think, good grief, what actually would he have seen? And he would have seen, you know, more or less jungle and a settlement, a few buildings, and then sailing ships in the harbour, sailing ships with their sails, ox carts on the road, not cars, obviously, and just more peaceful, obviously undeveloped. I'm trying to think if I can think of a modern equivalent where you can perhaps get a sense of how Singapore would have looked at the time. You know, if there's a park you can go to. But I think there probably isn't. You just have to think, you know, if you've been and visited the jungle, and then you just sort of imagine the jungle smothering Singapore, then that's more or less what you've seen. I mean, it was a settlement, and it was thriving and bustling and busy and very successful right from the get-go. But it was initially quite small and quite sort of hugging the river and the coast. It wasn't sprawling inland like it does now. And it has always been multinational, multiracial, very busy, lots of people coming and going since 1819. It's always been multiracial, multicultural, very busy, lots of trade. So some things would have stayed the same, but the actual physical environment, yes, would have looked very different.
Rosie, thank you so much for taking the time to come and talk to me today.
No, thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. That was great.
I've been speaking to Rosie Milne. You can find her book, Olivia and Sophia, at all good bookstores. You've been listening to Invisible Cities, Bookmark on the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.